ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to ABC Radio National.
Hello, I'm Michael Rowland, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, the late US Supreme Court Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg lived by the maxim, you can disagree without being disagreeable. What would she make of the current headwinds being faced by her colleagues on America's highest bench? RBG's former clerk, now chair of constitutional law at the University of California, Berkeley, Professor Amanda Tyler, joins me in a moment. Also ahead, part two of my very frank conversation with Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai on her mental health struggles and striving to break free of her good girl image. And could the mystery of pioneering American aviator Amelia Earhart's disappearance over the Pacific Ocean nearly 80 years ago be finally explained?
I'm feeling very optimistic. The issue in my mind is, if it's not the Electra, what is it? I mean, people have suggested, oh, maybe it's a tree. I don't think so. Maybe it's an alien spacecraft. Well, that would be interesting.
If it's not a bird or Superman, then surely it's a plane. You'll hear from a very determined archaeologist later this hour. In the 8 months since he resumed office, President Donald Trump has butted heads time and time again with the American court system, with judges, lawyers, and constitutional experts. He and his advisers argue he has a mandate from US voters and accuse the courts of getting in the way. Whether he's challenging the independence of agencies and institutions, deporting immigrants, slashing federal jobs, or setting tariffs, it's clearer than ever the president wants to push the boundaries of executive power. Professor Amanda Tyler is the chair of constitutional law at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research focuses on the Supreme Court and legal history. She's in Australia as a guest of the UNSW Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Public Law. Amanda, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Can I firstly get your reaction to the news that's broken overnight about the indictment of former national security hawk and President Trump advisor John Bolton on charges of mishandling classified information?
I think we need to put this new development in the context of recent indictments of individuals like James Comey, the former head of the FBI, and look at the larger landscape of what's happening at the United States Justice Department and among federal prosecutions, because many of them, and if I focus on the Comey one in particular, have followed through procedures that are not ordinary procedures. And because we've had special appointments, overriding career prosecutors, making indictments, that's very eyebrow-raising. And it raises a lot of questions about whether we're getting a little off track in terms of these important decisions and how the government is being run.
And to be clear on the Bolton case, it is a bit more nuanced than Comey and others because this investigation began under the Biden administration.
That's right.
But at the same time, Donald Trump has made no secret of his dislike of John Bolton and has made all sorts of threats regarding him over recent years.
I think this is one of many examples that we see in the Trump administration of where the president is saying things and taking actions that are unprecedented. And it's very disturbing.
How would you describe President Trump's relationship with the law and the courts in the US? Does he, in your view, conduct himself in a way you'd expect of a president?
I'm not sure what relationship he has with the law. He seems to buck a lot of longstanding precedents, a lot of longstanding norms. To be fair, presidents before him have pushed the envelope, but never as much as President Trump. And I think it's the perfect storm of several things that are happening at the same time in our government. We have a Congress that has not been functioning well for some time. And because of that, party loyalty trumps institutional interest. And so you see a Congress that is allowing the president to usurp its spending power, to usurp its power over trade and trade policy. And then you have a Supreme Court that, as of yet, really isn't treating Trump as sui generis, as exceptional. When I think, if you look at all the things that he's doing and how he has broken with so many norms, he is quite exceptional.
So we're talking there, Congress and the Supreme Court, the checks and balances coming under immense stress in the Trump presidency, Mark II.
I think they're under tremendous stress, and we're seeing a system that was designed not to allow any one branch to accede to exceptional power. The system is not working. And I think Congress is a big part of that, because a lot of the things that the president is doing, Congress has the power to check. Obviously, if you go back to the first administration, the impeachment power is one of the most important checks on the presidency. And I think if you had taken some of the actions, if you looked at historically some of the actions that he took and asked 30, 40 years ago, would he be impeached for them? I think the answer is an unequivocal yes. So it's tied up with the story of Congress not wanting to protect its own prerogatives in our constitutional structure.
You've written a book called Habeas Corpus, a very short introduction. For the listeners who may not know, what is habeas corpus and why is it coming up so frequently now in the conversation about the extent of Donald Trump's powers? Why is it particularly relevant right now in America?
Habeas corpus classically is a writ by which a court can order the presentation of someone who is in government custody, whether it's somebody who is imprisoned for criminal action or an immigrant that has been taken into custody and detained pending possible deportation or removal. And the reason it has come into such importance under the Trump administration is because, as everyone knows, immigration is a big issue on which he ran, and he is invoking many different means of trying to speed the removal of individuals. And some of those are quite exceptional. So I talked about how he has pushed some of the boundaries of historical precedents. A good example is his invocation of the Alien Enemies Act, which had not been invoked since World War II and has only ever been invoked in the context of war. And he did so to expeditiously attempt to remove alleged members of a gang from Venezuela, the TDA gang. And unsurprisingly, a lot of lawyers jumped in to bring habeas actions. And that's why we're seeing a lot of cases in that context and related contexts wind up at the Supreme Court.
Stephen Miller, his special advisor, has, I guess, said the quiet part out loud, and he's gone public saying, well, they're looking at this, the administration, as in winding back habeas corpus, suspending it. Can they do that?
Suspension requires a rebellion or invasion, and for the public safety to require it. Those are the words in the Constitution. That's the first issue. We would question whether those circumstances exist. The second problem for the Trump administration in terms of possibly suspending habeas is that it is in Article 1 of our Constitution, which governs the Congress and its powers. So it is fairly well accepted, with the exception of President Lincoln. So that's a big footnote to this, but it's fairly well accepted that this is a legislative power. So Congress would really need to take the lead here. And it has in every situation except for Lincoln, who has suspended habeas corpus during our Civil War, but then was later ratified. That action was later ratified by Congress. So you have all of those problems. But the bigger problem, I think, on the other hand, is as the president claims more and more power, the check, particularly when we're talking about individual liberty, is the courts. And so we need the courts to stand up and say, you can't do this. And interestingly, this is one context in which I think recently the Supreme Court has really pushed back. You know, some critics, including myself, might want them to push back more than they have, but they have pushed back a considerable amount in terms of his attempt to remove people expeditiously from the country without giving them any judicial process.
Could it be the case, though, that the administration, certainly some senior members of it, don't understand habeas corpus? Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, told a congressional hearing recently, and I'm quoting, when asked about what her definition of habeas corpus was, she said, "It's a constitutional right the president has to remove people from the US and suspend their rights." If you were marking Kristi Noem, law student's essay, and she wrote that, what would you do?
I unfortunately would have to fail her. That's just completely wrong.
Does it worry you? And she's a senior cabinet secretary that, based on that, she seemed to have no idea of what habeas corpus means.
You know, we can make jokes about it, but your question is actually the more important one, which is, yes, we should be worried that somebody has that much power in our government and is that ignorant of really important fundamental constitutional rights and rights of liberty that are at the heart of our constitutional tradition.
Should we be surprised that President Trump has this, I guess, transactional view of the work of the courts, the role of judges, when one of the reasons he was elected was to bring about change on the Supreme Court in the hope of reversing Roe versus Wade? Should a man of the legal fraternity in the US be surprised? Should you have seen this coming?
I think as you watch the recent appointments to the court over the last decade, much of what, maybe not all, but a good chunk of what has happened, I would have predicted. I would have predicted the downfall of Roe versus Wade, because a lot of the, just to take that example, a lot of the justices who have joined the court came up in a tradition of the Federalist Society, which is a conservative legal organization, and one of its most central tenets and objectives was to see Roe versus Wade overturned. And so that decision is not altogether surprising to me. The speed with which the change happened is what is surprising. In the case that overruled it, Dobbs, the Chief Justice, actually did not join the majority and would have taken a narrower ground. I think he, too, in the long term, would want to see Roe versus Wade overturned. But it's an example of where I think even some conservatives were a little bit surprised by the speed by which some of this change has happened.
On the Radio National Hour, you're hearing from Professor Amanda Tyler, who's the Chair of Constitutional Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Amanda, the Supreme Court has just begun its new term, and there are lots of potentially significant cases this time around when it comes to defining the reach of Donald Trump's presidential authority. For example, can you take us through the battle brewing over the president's attempts to take control of state National Guard units and deploy them in cities where he says there's rampant crime, cities like Chicago? What's going on there?
Well, he's running into a lot of trouble in the courts because the grounds that he's invoked for doing so are have limitations on his ability, and the facts on the ground aren't marrying. Can we redo that one?
Sure.
Sorry. He's running into a lot of trouble in the courts because he's making claims to justify the calling up of the National Guards that simply don't marry with the facts on the ground. So, for example, in one example in Portland recently, the federal trial judge, the federal district judge, said it's just simply not the case that this is a war zone. And that being said, it's important to underscore that the president has other sources of power that he can invoke, including our Insurrection Act, that would give him far more authority and actually probably allow him to do some of the things that he's doing. So even as currently the courts are rebuffing him in Chicago, in Portland, he is apparently actively considering invoking his powers under the Insurrection Act, and he could do all of these things that way. And that would be really unprecedented. That's another act that is gives the president quite exceptional power that has not been wielded in decades and has only been wielded in truly exceptional, extraordinary situations.
So whatever lower courts say about issues like the state National Guard, the Supreme Court can step in via its so-called shadow docket and issue its own ruling. So can you explain to me what a shadow docket is? I note that in your conversation at UNSW this week, you said it would be more accurate to describe it as an emergency docket.
Right. So traditionally, the Supreme Court grants review in cases on its what we call merits docket. Those cases receive months of briefing, oral argument, and then months of deliberation, usually before an opinion comes down. Also traditionally, when I clerked on the court 25 years ago, there was an emergency docket, but it entailed entirely cases involving death penalty, petitions right before somebody was going to be executed for where they would seek last-minute relief. Now the emergency docket, what some call the shadow docket, makes up almost half of what the Supreme Court is doing. So that is a very, very dramatic change that has happened at the court. And what it entails is the court getting involved in cases on a fast track and setting aside lower court orders often that have for example, stopped government action. And the court is taking these cases on very tight timelines. Mm. Sometimes we're talking about days, at most weeks.
What does this mean for proper process?
It's a very different process. And the problem that we see, a lot of legal academics see in what the court is doing, and you see it in many of their recent orders, for example, having to do with the president's power to remove Senate-confirmed heads of agencies, is that the court is granting relief on limited briefing, a very fast timeline, often no oral argument, and it's doing so in a situation where it's actually not acting in compliance with its existing precedents and granting the president the power to act in contravention of longstanding Supreme Court precedents. In other words, the court is making new law sometimes on the emergency docket, again, without its normal process. And that is very, very troubling.
On that note, Democratic Senator Cory Booker from New Jersey said earlier this year that all Americans should be alarmed by the Supreme Court's growing reliance on its shadow or emergency docket to resolve controversial cases without transparency. I'm guessing you agree with him. And how much should Americans be worried about what's going on here?
I do agree with him. I think it's interesting that the use of the emergency docket slowed down a little bit during the Biden administration, but now there's quite an uptick, especially in the seriousness or high profile nature of the cases that they're deciding on the emergency docket. And that raises, again, another eyebrow, if you will. Mm. How concerned people should be, I think they should be very concerned that we have a Supreme Court that is eager to enter every single high-profile issue on a fast track. That is not how the Supreme Court has typically historically operated. It has been a court of last resort after other judges with due extensive deliberation have looked at these hard issues and given their own views, and then the case winds its way up to the court and it has the full court merits process.
There are other cases on the slate that will require a full response from the Supreme Court justices, whether, for example, federal laws prohibit the president from removing members of agencies designed by Congress to be independent, whether he can fire a member of the Federal Reserve Board, he's been very public about that, whether the president can legally apply unilateral tariffs on foreign imports. There's a theme here, isn't there, Amanda, that the scope, we keep returning to this issue, the scope of executive power. How critical a moment is this in America's legal history?
It's enormously important because the Supreme Court has decided many recent decisions in which it has allowed for a more robust vision of executive power. And where one branch gets more power, it means other branches are losing power. And so the balance that we've had in place is, if you will, in my view, out of calibration. That being said, what is, I think, really interesting about what is happening is that right now it favors Trump. But if the White House changes hands and the Supreme Court does go as far as it might, and for example, take the case of Lisa Cook, the member of the Fed that the president is trying to remove right now, the court has granted full review in that case. If they allow the president under a theory that the president has to control the entire executive branch, including independent agencies and boards, if they allow him to remove her without cause, which is the requirement otherwise that Congress had put in place, it means that every time we have a new administration, every one of these agencies, including those that were designed to be independent and, for example, control our monetary policy, that
a not insignificant thing.
A not insignificant thing, that the slate of those individuals running it will potentially change hands completely every 4 years, and we will have a dramatic pendulum swinging of important national policies where a lot of people, myself included, think that there is value in stability.
We all like stability. My guest on the Radio National Hour is Professor Amanda Tyler, a constitutional law and Supreme Court expert reflecting on Donald Trump's relationship with the American legal system. What about judges? President Trump routinely criticizes, calls out judges at all levels of the legal system. What's it like being a judge in America at the moment?
I think it's extremely difficult and challenging. This is another example of where Trump's actions are exceptional. We really haven't seen a president in history as regularly and as directly by name go after judges. There have been certainly examples of where presidents have criticized, sometimes quite aggressively, Supreme Court decisions. President Obama was quite critical of campaign finance, the decisions in Citizens United.
There's one thing to criticize judgments, but it's another thing entirely to be deeply personal, launch personal attacks, which the president does.
Yes, and it puts judges' lives at danger. Mm. The security that judges have to have now, particularly the higher profile judges in our country, is unprecedented. And it, I think, I would assume, makes somebody who is approached about the prospect of being a judge think very carefully about whether this is actually something they want to put themselves through and something they want to put their families through.
Finally, after Harvard Law School, you worked for, among others, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You later co-authored a book with her. What would she think about these attacks on the law? Would she have confidence in the construction of the courts, the robustness of the law to resist this kind of political onslaught?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to answer for her. But I would say that she believed passionately and deeply in the ability of the law to advance progress and to protect individual liberty and protect individual rights. I think she would be concerned by many of the developments that we've discussed. She would be concerned that perhaps the balance of powers among the branches of our government are out of whack a little bit. I think she would be very concerned that the Supreme Court is not functioning as it used to, and that process has taken a back seat sometimes to end results. She was, first and foremost, a procedure professor. And so procedure mattered very deeply to her. It was sort of the foundation of the legal system and the rule of law. And so I think she would be very concerned by the rise of the emergency docket and the fact that the court is entering so many big decisions or big issues on a short time frame and deciding, really making new law on the emergency docket. I think that would really concern her. And then I'm sure you could go through various decisions they've rendered, for sure, the Dobbs decision overruling Roe versus Wade, and she would be quite critical of those as well. But she did, in the end, really believe in the rule of law as the foundation of our society, and I think she was ever optimistic.
Disturbing times in the US legal system. Amanda, thank you so much for joining me on the Radio National Hour.
My pleasure.
Professor Amanda Tyler is the Thomas David and Judith Swope Clark Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Yesterday, we brought you part one of my conversation with women's education activist Malala Yousafzai about her new memoir, Finding My Way, which is a coming-of-age story and a chance to reintroduce herself to the world as a person beyond her activism. In part two of our conversation, I began by asking her about an interview she did with British Vogue magazine in 2021, in which she challenged the idea of marriage and then found herself being labelled a traitor to traditional values.
What is heartbreaking about such criticism or attacks is that people take it out of context and they do it deliberately. It's done deliberately because if anybody goes and reads the British Vogue article, they can clearly see that it's a 23-year-old girl, a recent graduate, and she is just confused about her future and she's simply questioning the institution of marriage, and she's unsure. And I think every young woman out there should have the right to be unsure and question things. And I just never thought that it would be turned into such a big propaganda, like saying that I'm against the institution of marriage. But the other part, which I felt people were looking away from, was how I grew up in a culture where child marriage is a reality, where forced marriage is a reality for girls. And marriage did become a scary word for me growing up, that I thought, okay, maybe I can't change the whole institution, and that's not a fight I can take on my shoulders, but what I can do is distance myself from it, and I will never get married. But then I was here, you know, in love with this guy, and I knew the only way we could be together, according to our culture, was to get married. So for me, I was just coming to terms with does accepting marriage mean I am giving up somehow to, in my dedication to protecting women's rights and girls' rights? And then I realized that, you know, we as people define our cultures and we can redefine them. We can redefine these institutions. So for, in my case, it was purely about how my husband and I came to this mutual understanding, but that's still not the reality for everybody out there. So I do not approve of like marriage, and I also do not disapprove of it, but I will keep questioning it and I will keep talking about the girls who lose their future. And, you know, when it comes to people criticizing me and all of that, I think it will somehow always be there. But I hope that more people are just, you know, slightly kinder and try to understand other people. I think it's just really important for our humanity.
There should be much more of that, that's for sure. You're listening to the Radio National Hour with me, Michael Rowland. My guest is Malala Yousafzai, and we're talking about her new memoir, Finding My Way. When you received your Oxford results, Malala, you described it as a deeply personal victory. You wrote, in fact, "Now, no matter where my life went next, I was a college graduate and I always would be. It didn't mean the end of misogyny or an enduring triumph for the right to education, of course. This was a personal victory between me and the men who'd tried to stop me. The fight was over. I had won." How big a moment was that for you, finally getting that university degree?
In that moment, I was living my dream. I remembered the 11-year-old Malala who was banned from her education by the Taliban. I remember the 15-year-old Malala who was shot by the Taliban for speaking out. I remember the Malala who was going everywhere in the world to advocate for girls' rights, to be able to complete their school and follow their dreams. And here I was, a graduate from college, and I felt like I was living my dream. And it felt like a personal victory. I know that this was not an open public fight that I had taken. I still continue to fight every day for all 120 million girls who are out of school, but this was to live that different pathway of life that I imagined during the Taliban's time.
I noticed throughout the book, Malala, there are a few examples of this push and pull between who you are and who you want to be. Should you study or go out? Should you get married or not? And your pride in being Pakistani, but also you want to do things differently to the traditional way. Do you feel as though you've solved these questions for yourself, that this internal dilemma, I guess? Or do you think that life is always about navigating these very different parts of ourselves?
I think life is about navigating it, and it's allowing yourself to think through it, to have the exposure and experience. And I do not expect myself to have all the answers for any questions, dilemmas in the future about career opportunities, about, you know, family life. But I think I'll be kinder to myself in ensuring that I give myself the time to think through it, to understand, you know, all the pathways.
You write that your childhood forced you to grow up very quickly, while Oxford let you feel young again and enjoy this liberation. The pandemic reminded you that time is finite as well. Malala, where do you feel you are now in terms of time, in terms of maturity, and in terms of purpose?
In this moment, I feel like I have found that young woman within me. I have accepted myself at this age, and I have accepted my role as an activist, and really understood how I can be of better help, how I can be of a better service to my mission for girls' education. So for me, it's a few things. One is empowering other girls and other girls activists. From my foundation, Malala Fund, we invest in other girls and other women activists who are advocating for girls' right to complete their education in Pakistan, Nigeria, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, Brazil, all of these places, because I started as a girl activist and I do not want that story to be an exceptional story. I know that this is not a unique story at all. There are incredible women and girls out there who are doing work on the ground. I have met them. I have seen their work. They are coming up with brilliant solutions to help more girls complete their education. So we are giving them support directly to be those change makers. I want people to see that there are incredible women out there, and let's share our support with them.
The Malala Fund is continuing to do some great work, but at the same time, we keep hearing the situation, for instance, in Afghanistan, for women, especially young girls, is not getting better. In many respects, it's getting worse. Do you find that intensely frustrating, despite all of your efforts, despite efforts by other women like you, groups like the one you run, that in Afghanistan, it is still a very, very bad outlook for young girls?
What's happening in Afghanistan is truly heartbreaking. The Taliban have erased women from public life. They have denied them every right you can think of. And Afghan women activists are recognizing this system as a form of gender apartheid, which means it is systematic oppression. Afghanistan right now is the only country where girls cannot complete their education. They cannot go to university. And this has been happening for the past 4 years. And I remember that time when the Taliban took control and Afghan women were crying. They were screaming at world leaders that there has to be accountability. We need to hold the Taliban account. And what was shocking to me, how leaders and people were giving the Taliban a second chance, saying that these Taliban are different. They will allow girls to school and let's just give them a chance. While women who had suffered were told that they are just, you know, very sensitive, and they are, and they should give the Taliban like a second try. That was truly disturbing. That is disturbing because it is just shocking how every leader and every country calls themselves a feminist country, and they talk about bringing equality for women. And then when we are witnessing right in front of our eyes how women and girls are treated as second-class citizens and are denied every right from work to education to playing sports and any public presence, leaders just look away. So, but despite all of this, it is the activism of the Afghan women and girls that gives me hope. Through Malala Fund, we provide alternative education. We are supporting the Afghan women's campaign to codify gender apartheid in the Crime Against Humanity Treaty to have like more accountability in the international system, because protecting the right of education for Afghan girls is an investment in their future. It builds resilience among them. And then a campaign to codify gender apartheid is not just about protecting women in Afghanistan, but it is bringing safety and protection for women everywhere.
Malala, finally, you have squeezed so much into your 28 years, decades into just 28 years. What do you hope the next 28 years hold for you?
I hope it's a lot of fun. I hope we see a difference in helping as many girls get access to education and follow their dreams. I am hoping for a world where talking about women and girls is not just limited to a few conferences and speeches, that we are actually investing in young women. We're investing in their education. We are moving more capital there. We are investing in their businesses. And we are talking about giving real power to women, I think, and putting more effort into not taking away their power, not taking away their rights. I hope that we have codified gender apartheid by then, and I hope there is more security and more safety for women and girls, that they're not vulnerable, their rights cannot be taken away. So I'm very ambitious and I have many dreams, and I hope that they come true.
As we all do. Malala Yousafzai, thank you so much for speaking to us on the Radio National Hour.
Thank you so much. So wonderful speaking to you.
That was women's education activist Malala Yousafzai discussing her new memoir, Finding My Way.
On ABC Radio National,
we examine the forces that shape how we live
and who we have become.
Health services fail Australians.
Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock.
From the economy
to the big ideas.
From fearless debates
to the events that timestamp our lives.
A political eruption across the United States,
Russia, China, and they have veto.
Go deep.
To challenge, to question,
and explore our complex world.
ABC Radio National.
This is Michael Rowland, sitting in for Fran Kelly on the Radio National Hour.
For nearly 90 years, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart has fueled books, films, and endless conspiracy theories. What really happened to her plane as she attempted to become the first woman to fly around the world in 1937? A 16-day search failed to find Earhart, her navigator Fred Noonan, or any trace of her Lockheed Electra aircraft. Now a high-stakes expedition is setting out to solve one of aviation's greatest and lasting mysteries. In just a few weeks, a team of American scientists and researchers will travel to a remote atoll in the South Pacific to investigate a submerged object they believe could just be Amelia Earhart's plane. Leading the mission is Rick Pettigrew. He is the executive director of the Archaeological Legacy Institute in Oregon. Rick, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
Tell us about this expedition to the atoll Nikumaru. It's one of the most remote atolls in the Pacific. Why do you believe this is the right place to search for Amelia Earhart's plane?
Well, first of all, we're following the footsteps of TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, who have been investigating that place since 1989. And they have compiled a very impressive body of evidence, which makes it very, very likely that Amelia and Fred ended up on Nikumaru. So that I'll just simply point to that. And then beyond that, the Turaya object itself was first seen as satellite imagery in 2020. We followed that up by putting together another couple of dozen satellite pictures, and then followed that up by examining other photographic and video evidence. And we think we have a really great set of evidence. And I would point people to our page at archaeologychannel.org/Turaya, which is spelled T-A-R-A-I-A, where we compile all that information.
So what exactly is the Turaya object, or what does it look like on those images?
Well, I guess you could tell me what you think it looks like. It's a fairly big object. It seems pretty substantial. It's the same order of magnitude as the Electra aircraft, which was flown by Amelia Earhart. But I don't think we can see the whole thing because it's embedded in the sediment. So we're seeing only part of it. And at different times, we see more and sometimes less. Right now, it's, I think, covered with a thin veneer of sediment. So we don't see the actual object, but we do see the impression of it in the bottom of the lagoon. But we've been following the image, you know, for a number of years through the satellite images. And so we know exactly where it is. And we know what that pattern in the bottom of the lagoon represents. And that's the Turaya object.
Okay. And has it become more potentially obvious to you through those various satellite images over the years, as, for instance, sand has shifted and the like on that atoll?
Sure. I mean, there's a distinct pattern. It appears that a big storm, Tropical Cyclone Pam in 2015, uncovered it. And just as you may be familiar with shipwrecks on the beach in some places where they're uncovered by storms, which will wash away the sand. And then they get covered up again as the waves continue to deposit sand on the beach. It's a similar situation. In 2015, Tropical Cyclone Pam swept into the lagoon. The object became very visible for a number of years until finally by about 2021 or 2022, it became much, much less visible. And now it's simply a pattern in the bottom of the lagoon. That's why I believe that it's this thin layer of sediment. We're going to go there and remove some of that sediment and take a look at it.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour with me, Michael Rowland. My guest is Rick Pettigrew. He's the executive director of the Archaeological Legacy Institute, which is leading the search for Amelia Earhart's missing plane 88 years after it disappeared over the Pacific. So, Rick, you'll be leading a team that includes researchers from Purdue University, which has deep ties to Amelia Earhart. She was a faculty member there in the 1930s. Walk us through the logistics in getting this team to such a remote island in the South Pacific.
Wow, it would take me a long time. It is a very complex operation. We're bringing people from many different places. They're coming from Florida, Kentucky, Indiana, California, Oregon, and British Columbia. Plus, we're bringing in one representative from the Republic of Kiribati as a representative of that country. But Nikumaru is part of that country. And so transportation is a challenge. We also are bringing lots of equipment because we're going to be setting up a technology station on the island with solar power, Starlink antenna. We're going to set up a weather station. device for measuring the tides. We're going to have a security camera. And this is all going to be left there when we leave. And it's designed to survive 1 year without any human intervention. So it's a big job, big task, a big plan, and a lot of complications, including things like shipping 700 pounds of equipment from Oregon to Majuro, little island, little place in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the capital of the Marshall Islands.
It's quite the operation. You're right. So what happens, Rick, once your team is actually on the atoll? What kind of tools and technology will be using when you're there to determine whether this image that you've uncovered here on the satellite image could in fact be Amelia Earhart's plane?
Sure. We're going to go through a process. First of all, photography using drones and so forth. We're going to do everything we can before disturbing it. We're going to do everything that's remote without disturbing it, including magnetometers, sonar devices, before we do a hydro probe, which basically is physically probing with a pipe adamant to determine the outline of the object. Once we have all that information, then we'll know precisely where to put our hydraulic dredge. And the hydraulic dredge will be simply suck sediment off the object so that we can expose it and get a look at it.
How long do you think that process will take if all things hold up?
Right. So we've allocated 5 days, 5 working days. We're going to be traveling back and forth between our ships and the site each day. I believe that within those 5 days, we can accomplish this task, and that's why we've designated that period of time. And we'll see when we get there, but it's going to take first a 1 day just to get to the site, because we have to cut our way through the forest to get to the lagoon. We have to bring boats around through the passage into the lagoon so that we have vehicles to ferry us back and forth to the site, which is across the lagoon from the near shore of the lagoon.
President Donald Trump, of course, recently ordered the release of government records on Earhart's disappearance. Rick, do you think these newly declassified files could support or even challenge what you find on this expedition? And do they show up anything that wasn't in the public domain already?
Right. That's a really good question. I seriously doubt that there's anything in there that is going to have any impact on anything that we're doing. We have no idea, no evidence that there are documents that somehow have important information that is not already known.
There have been close calls, I guess you can call them, that over the decades with people thinking they've discovered what looks like the wreckage or satellite images in the past. How close have people come to thinking it's Earhart's plane and all of a sudden finding it's just a bunch of rocks or a fallen coconut tree or something?
We've seen that over and over, haven't we? Mm. And I get that. I get that that comment and objection all the time. All I can say is that I'm a scientist. I'm an archaeologist. I look at evidence very carefully, very seriously. And based on the empirical evidence that we have, I can say one thing for certain. That is that knowing what we know with the evidence that we have at our disposal, somebody has to go and look. 100% sure. Somebody has to go and look at it. I can't say that I'm sure that it's the Electra aircraft. I think it very likely is, but I'm 100% sure that we have to go and look at it.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. I'm talking to Rick Pettigrew, the Executive Director of the Archaeological Legacy Institute in Oregon, on the search for Amelia Earhart's missing plane. So what's your theory about what happened to Earhart and navigator Fred Noonan? They were attempting to complete this circumnavigational flight when the plane disappeared in July 1937. It's widely believed they possibly ran out of fuel and crashed into the ocean. Is that what you think happened?
No, not at all. I basically subscribe to the Nicomoroa hypothesis, which holds that Amelia and Fred did have enough fuel on board to go as far south as Nicomoroa. They followed a line of position, which they described in the last radio message. That line of position passes right over Nicomoroa. It's very likely that she saw the island, landed on the reef flat at the northwest corner of the island, which is flat like a tarmac, landed safely, and was marooned there, sent out radio messages over a period of about 4 days and nights. Eventually, the tide rose, lifted the aircraft off the reef, crashed it up against the rock, broke it into pieces, and the biggest pieces with a fuselage and the tail filled with empty fuel tanks. And the current, the tide pushed that object into the lagoon and to the opposite shore, where the Triad Peninsula is located, and that's why we find it there.
And based on your theory, so what happened then? Amelia and Fred just died of starvation on this atoll.
Well, we have no idea, you know, really what happened to Amelia and Fred. There are a lot of different thoughts about that. There are a lot of ways of perishing on this island. Of course, dehydration is perhaps the biggest danger. If she wasn't able to find enough fresh water, that would have been fatal. There's plenty of food, to be sure, but one could be, you know, one could cut oneself on the reef rock, get an infection. You know, there's a variety of ways that one could perish, but I think dehydration is the biggest danger.
There have been so many conspiracy theories, as I mentioned at the start, Rick, about this. What's the wildest conspiracy theory you've heard about Earhart's disappearance?
Oh, I suppose captured by aliens ended up becoming a housewife in New Jersey.
I've read that one. It's pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I know some people believe in the Japanese capture hypothesis. I don't subscribe to that at all. I don't think that there was enough fuel on board to get to the Marshall Islands or anywhere close to the Marshall Islands. I don't see that was a possibility. So, yeah, I think we can narrow down the list of plausible hypotheses to a very small number.
Yeah, let's keep it reality-based. I think you're on the right track there, Rick. So listen, take us back to the 1930s. How big a deal was Amelia Earhart then, and certainly how big a deal was her planned circumnavigation of the globe?
Oh, huge. She had already experienced two ticker tape parades in New York City. She was a rock star. I mean, she was, everybody knew about Amelia Earhart. Probably a billion people followed her flight as she was making her way around the world. Of course, they didn't have internet or TV in those days. They were glued to the radios and reading the newspapers all about it.
And describe the aircraft. Was it cutting edge at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. The Lockheed Electra aircraft was a cutting edge aircraft. It was brand new. This particular aircraft was constructed in 1935, but the design was entirely modern. It was a turning point in aviation history in terms of its design and engineering. So she was flying the most modern aircraft that there was. It made a difference in the history of aviation. A lot of planes followed that pattern after that.
Rick, you've described the possibility of finding Earhart's plane as the discovery of a lifetime. What would confirmation of the wreckage mean, not just for aviation history, but for Amelia Earhart's legacy?
Well, it would create a concrete reminder of Amelia Earhart. I mean, finding that aircraft creates an object that people can visit. If we can find it and potentially recover it and maybe send it to Purdue University, where they really definitely want to have it, it would be a place where people could come and see the actual thing, kind of a memorial. I don't think it's going to change the significance of Amelia Earhart, but it's going to create something that will remind people of her.
And finally, as you're about to embark on this expedition, you're feeling cautiously optimistic. Is that the best way of describing it?
I'm feeling very optimistic. The issue in my mind is, if it's not the Electra, what is it? I mean, people have suggested, oh, maybe it's a tree. I don't think so. Maybe it's an alien spacecraft. Well, that would be interesting.
It would.
But nobody has suggested, you know, a really good alternative to what it might be. Given what it looks like in the satellite images and the other evidence that we have, it's substantial, it's metallic. What else could it be?
We'll be watching the expedition with great interest here, that's for sure. Rick, thank you so much for joining me on the Radio National Hour.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Rick Pettigrew is the Executive Director of the Archaeological Legacy Institute, which is leading the search for Amelia Earhart's missing plane 88 years after it disappeared over the Pacific. And that's it for me for today and this week. Thank you very much for your company. My thanks to the great Radio National Hour team, producers Kylie Morris, Claire O'Halloran, Linda Lopresti, and our executive producer, Katie Heyman. A reminder to tune into Radio National's special coverage over the weekend of the top 100 books of the 21st century countdown. Find out whether your choices made the top 10. To ease you into your weekend, we leave you with Richard Tognetti playing Schubert's Fantasy in C with pianist Constantin Chamret.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listener.